Alban had few opinions on the subject of marriage. His attitude to women was negative, but in particular, he was not attracted to Miss Cuff. Coming down early for dinner, red satin dress cut low, she attacked the silence with loud laughter before he had spoken. He recollected having heard that she was abnormal, at 25 of statuesque development, still detained in childhood. The two other ladies, in beaded satins, made entrances of a surprising formality. Old Mr. Rossiter, uncle to Mrs. Tray, came last, more sourly. They sat for some time without the addition of lamplight. No sound came from other parts of the castle. Miss Cuff was an heiress to whom the castle belonged and whose guests they all were. But she carefully followed the movements of her aunt, Mrs. Tray. Her ox eyes moved from face to face in happy submission rather than expectancy. She was continually preoccupied with attempts at gravity, as though holding down her skirts in a high wind. Mrs. Tray and Miss Carbon combined to cover her excitement. Still, their looks frequently stole from the company to the windows, of which there were too many. He received a strong impression someone outside was waiting to come in. At last, with a sigh, they got up. Dinner had been announced. The castle was built on high ground, commanding the estuary. A steep hill with trees continued above it. On fine days, the view was remarkable. Now, in continuous evening rain, the wooded line of the further shore could be seen, and nearer the windows, a smothered island with the stump of a watchtower. Where the castle stood, a higher tower had answered the islands, later a keep, then wings had been added. Now the fine, peaceful residence had French windows opening onto the terrace. Invasions from the water would henceforth be social, perhaps amorous. On the slope down from the terrace, trees began again, almost, but not quite, concealing the destroyer. The destroyer had come today. The estuary, it appeared, was deep, with a channel buoyed up it. By a term of the treaty, English ships were permitted to anchor in these waters. "But they've been afraid of the rain," chimed in Valeria Cuff. "Hush," said her aunt. "That's silly. Sailors would be accustomed to getting wet." But Miss Carbon reported that spring there had already been one destroyer. Two of the officers had been seen dancing at the hotel at the head of the estuary. Miss Carbon, blonde, not 40, and an attachment of Mrs. Tray's, shook her head despondently. "We were all away at Easter. Wasn't it curious they should have come then? But next evening the officers did not go to the hotel. They climbed up here through the trees to the terrace. You see, they had no idea. Friends of ours were staying here at the castle, and they apologized. Our friends invited them in to supper." "Did they accept?" the three ladies said in a breath. "Oh, yes, they came." Valeria added urgently, "So don't you think..." "So tonight we have a destroyer to greet you," Mrs. Tray said quickly to Alban. "It is quite an event. The waters are very lonely. The steamers have given up since the bad times. There's hardly a pleasure boat. The weather this year has driven visitors right away." "You are beautifully remote." "Yes," agreed Miss Carbon. "Do you know much about the Navy? Do you think, for instance, that this is likely to be the same destroyer?"
"Will they remember?" Valeria's bust was almost on the table, but with a rustle, Mrs. Tray pressed Valeria's toe, for the dining room also looked out across the estuary, and the great girl had not once taken her eyes from the window. Dinner was being served very slowly. Candles, possible to see from the water, were lit now. Some wet peonies glistened. They were sorry to think of anything out in the rain tonight.
"The decks must be streaming," said Miss Carbon. Then Valeria, exclaiming, "Please excuse me," pushed her chair in and ran from the room. "She is impulsive," explained Mrs. Tray. In the drawing room, empty of Valeria, the standard lamps had been lit. Through their ballet skirt shades, rose and lemon, they gave out a deep, welcoming light. Alban, at the lady's invitation, undraped the piano. He played, but they could see he was not pleased. Mendelssohn was exasperating to them. They opened all four windows to let the music downhill. They preferred not to draw the curtains, the air, though damp, being pleasant tonight, they said. The piano was damp, but Alban played almost all his heart out. He played out the indignation of years his mild manner concealed. He had failed to love. Partners at dinner gave him less than half their attention, and he knew some spring had dried up at the root of the world. He played badly, but they were unmusical. Valeria, glittering vastly, appeared in a window.
"Come in!" her aunt cried in indignation. She would die of a chill, childless, in fact unwedded. The castle would have to be sold, and where would they all be?
"Lights down there!" Valeria shouted above the music.
They had to run out for a moment, laughing and holding cushions over their bare shoulders. Alban left the piano. They looked boldly down from the terrace. There were ever so many portholes, all lit up.
"Well, perhaps they're playing bridge," said Miss Carbon.
"Let's go for a row now. Let's go for a row with a lantern," besought Valeria, jumping and pulling her aunt's elbow. They produced such indignation she disappeared again, wet satin skirts and all, into the bushes.
"They must lose a great deal playing cards throughout an evening for high stakes," Miss Carbon said with concern as they all sat down again.
"Yet, if you come to think of it, somebody must win."
But the naval officers, who so joyfully supped at Easter, had been, Miss Carbon knew, a Mr. Graves and a Mr. Garrett. They would certainly lose. At all events, it is better than dancing at the hotel. There would be nobody of their type. I expect they are best where they are. Mr. Alban, a Viennese waltz.
Valeria's mind was made up. She was a princess. Not for nothing had she had the dining room silver polished and all set out. She would pace round in red satin that swished behind her, while Mr. Alban kept on playing a loud waltz. They would be dazed at all she had to offer.
When he and she were married, she inclined a little to Mr. Garrett, they would invite all the Navy up the estuary and give them tea. Her estuary would be filled up like a regatta, with loud, excited battleships tooting to one another and flags flying. The terrace would be covered with grateful sailors, leaving room for the band. She would keep the peacocks her aunt did not allow. His friends would be surprised to notice that Mr. Garrett had meanwhile become an admiral, all gold. He would lead the other admirals into the castle and say, "These are my wife's statues. She has given them to me. One is Mars, one is Mercury. We have a Venus, but she is not dressed. And wait till I show you our silver and gold plates." The Navy would be unable to tear itself away. She had been excited for some weeks at the idea of marrying Mr. Alban, but now the lovely appearance of the destroyer put him right out of her mind. He would not have done. He was not handsome. Her friends had told her Mr. Garrett was quite a Viking. She was so very familiar with his appearance that she felt sometimes they had already been married for years, though still, sometimes, he could not realize his good luck. She still had to remind him the island was hers, too. There was some little hitch about the arrival of Mr. Garrett. She had heard that gentlemen sometimes could not tie their ties. And now he was late and would be discouraged, so she must go halfway down to the water and wave a lantern. She put her two hands over the lantern, then smothered it in her dress. She had a panic. Supposing she should prefer Mr. Graves? He would teach her to dance and take her to Naples and Paris.
Oh dear. Then they must fight for her. That was all there was to it.
She let the lantern out of her skirts and waved. Inconceivably, the destroyer took no notice. Undisturbed by oars, the rain stood up from the water, not a light rose to peer, and the gramophone, though it remained very faint, did not cease or alter. In mackintoshes, Mr. Rossiter and Alban, meanwhile, made their way to the boathouse. Alban did not know why.
"If that goes on," said Mr. Rossiter, nodding towards Valeria's lantern, "they'll fire one of their guns at us. Nervous as cats. It's high time that girl was married. She's a nice girl in many ways, too."
Couldn't we get the lantern away from her?
"Oh, she screamed the place down. She's of age now."
Chuckling equably, Mrs. Tray's uncle unlocked and pulled open the boathouse door. A bat whistled out. "Why are we here?"
"Oh, she might come from the boat. She's a fine oar," said Mr. Rossiter wisely.
The place was familiar to him. He lit an oil lamp and, sitting down on a trestle with a staunch air of having done what he could, reached a bottle of whiskey out of the boat. He motioned the bottle to Alban.
"It's a wild night," he said. "Oh, well, we don't have these destroyers every day. It's a pity you don't want a wife. You'll be better for a wife to see a young fellow like you. She's got a nice character. She's a girl you could shape. She's got a nice income.
The bat returned from the rain and knocked round the lamp.
Bat! Auburn squealed irrepressibly, and with his hand to his ear where he still felt it, fled from the boathouse. Mr. Rossiter's conversation continued. Auburn's pump squelched as he ran. He skidded along the causeway and balked at the upward steps.
His soul squelched equally. He had been warned. He had been warned. He had heard they were all mad. He had erred out of headiness and curiosity. Now he had no other pumps in this country, no idea where to buy them, and a ducal visit ahead.
Halfway up to the castle, darkness was once more absolute. Her lantern had gone out. He could orientate himself, in spite of himself, by her sobbing. Absolute desperation. He pulled up so short that, for balance, he had to cling to a creaking tree.
"Hi," she croaked, then. "You are there, I heard you."
"Miss Cuff."
"How too bad you are. I never heard you rowing. I thought you were never coming."
"Quietly, my dear girl."
"Come up quickly. I haven't seen you. Come up to the windows."
"Miss Cuff,
don't you remember the way?"
As sure but not so noiseless as a cat in the dark, Valeria hurried to him.
"Mr. Garrett," she panted, "I'm Miss Cuff. Where have you been? I've destroyed my beautiful red dress and they've eaten up your dinner. But we're still waiting. Don't be afraid. You'll soon be there now. I'm Miss Cuff. This is my castle."
"Listen, it's I, Mr. Auburn."
"Shh, shh, Mr. Auburn. Mr. Garrett has landed."
Her cry, his voice, some breath of the joyful intelligence brought the others onto the terrace, blind with lamplight.
"Valeria?
Mr. Garrett has landed."
Mrs. Tray said to Miss Carbon under her breath, "Mr. Garrett has come."
Auburn, looking up, saw their arms and shoulders under the bright rain. Close by, Valeria's fingers creaked on her warm, wet satin. She laughed like a princess, magnificently justified. Their unseen faces were all three lovely, and in the silence after the laughter, such a strong tenderness reached him that standing there in full manhood, he was, for a moment, not exiled. For the moment, without moving or speaking, he stood in the dark, in a flame, as though all three said, "My darling." Perhaps it was best for them all that early when next day first lighted the rain, the destroyer steamed out. Below the extinguished castle where Valeria lay with her arms wide, past the boathouse where Mr. Rossiter lay insensible and the bat hung masked in its wings, down the estuary into the open sea.